memory of knowing that we had each other for a while. You are a romantic fool, just as Mother always said.
She said that?
Mother's never wrong, said Dico. She also said that I would never have a better friend than you. She was right, then.
Be my true friend, Hunapu, said Dico. Never speak of this to me again. Work with me. And when the time comes to go into the past, go with me. Let our marriage be the work we do together. And let our children be the future that we build. Let me come to whatever husband I do have without the memories of another husband or another lover to encumber me. Let me face my future with confidence in your friendship instead of guilt, whether it comes from denying you or accepting you. Will you do that for me?
No, shouted Hunapu silently. Because that isn't necessary. We don't have to do that. We can be happy now, and still be happy in the future, and you're wrong, completely wrong about this. Except that if she believed that marriage or an affair would make her unhappy, then it would make her unhappy, and so she was right, for herself. And loving him would be a bad thing for her. So, did he love her or merely want to own her? Was it her happiness he cared about, or satisfaction of his own needs?
Yes, said Hunapu. I'll do that for you.
It was then and only then that she kissed him, leaned down to him and kissed him on the lips, not briefly, but not with passion either. With love, simple love, a single kiss, and then she left, and left him desolate.
Chapter 8 Dark Futures. Father Talavera had listened to all the eloquent, methodical, sometimes impassioned arguments, but he had known from the start that he had to make the final decision about Colón by himself. How many years had they listened to Colón and harangued him, too, so that all were weary of the same conversations endlessly repeated? For so many years, since the Queen first asked him to lead the examination of Colón's claims, nothing had changed. Maldonado still seemed to regard Colón's very existence as an affront, while Deza seemed almost infatuated with the Genovese. The others still lined up behind one or the other, or, like Talavera himself, remained neutral, or rather, they seemed neutral. They merely wavered like grass, dancing in whatever wind was blowing. How many times had each one come to him privately and spent long minutes, sometimes hours, explaining their views, which always amounted to the same thing. They agreed with everybody. I alone am truly neutral, thought Talavera. I alone am swayed by no argument whatsoever. I alone can listen to Maldonado bring forth sentences from ancient, long-forgotten writings in languages so obscure that quite possibly no one ever spoke them except the original writer himself. I alone can listen to him and hear only the voice of a man who is determined not to allow the slightest new idea to disrupt his own perfect understanding of the world. I alone can listen to Deza, eloquizing about Colón's brilliance in finding truth so long overlooked by scholars, and hear only the voice of a man who yearned to be a knight-errant from the romances, championing a cause which is noble only because he champions it. I alone am neutral, thought Talavera, because I alone understand the utter stupidity of the entire conversation. Which of these ancients, they all quote with such certainty, was lifted by the hand of God to see the earth from an appropriate vantage point? Which of them was given calipers by the hand of God to make an accurate measurement of the diameter of the earth? No one knew anything. The only serious attempt at measurement more than 1,000 years before could have been disastrously flawed by the tiniest inconsistency in the original observations. All the argument in the world could not change the fact that if you build the foundation of your logic upon guesswork, then your conclusions will be guesswork also. Of course, Talavera could never say this to anyone else. He had not risen to his position of trust by freely expressing his skepticism about the wisdom of the ancients. On the contrary, all who knew him were sure that he was utterly orthodox. He had labored hard to make sure they had that opinion of him. And in a sense, they were right. He simply defined orthodoxy quite differently from them. Talavera did not put his faith in Aristotle or Ptolemy. He already knew what the examination of Colón was demonstrating in such agonizing detail. that for every ancient authority there was a contradictory authority just as ancient and, he suspected, just as ignorant. Let the other scholars claim that God had whispered to Plato as he wrote the Symposium. Talavera knew better. Aristotle was clever, but his wise sayings were no likelier to be true than the opinions of other clever men. Talavera put his faith in only one person, Jesus Christ. His were the only words that Talavera cared about, Christ's cause, the only cause that stirred his soul. Every other cause, every other idea, every other plan or party or faction or individual was to be judged in light of how it would either help or hinder the cause of Christ. Talavera had realized early in his rise within the church that the monarchs of Castile and Aragon were good for the cause of Christ, and so he enlisted himself in their camp. They found him to be a valuable servant because he was deft at marshalling the resources of the church in their support. His technique was simple. See what the monarchs want and need in order to further their effort to make of Spain a Christian kingdom, driving the unbeliever from any power or influence, and then interpret all the pertinent texts to show how Scripture, church tradition, and all the ancient writers were united in supporting the course that the monarchs had already determined to pursue. The funny thing, or when he was in another mood, the sad thing, was that no one ever caught on to his method. When he invariably brought in scholarship that would support the cause of Christ and the monarchs of Spain, everyone assumed that this meant that the course the monarchs were pursuing was the right one, not that Talavera had been clever about manipulating the texts. It was as if they did not realize the texts could be manipulated. And yet, they all manipulated and interpreted and transformed the ancient writings. Certainly Maldonado did it to defend his own elaborate preconceptions and Deza just as much to attack them. But none of them seemed to know that this was what they were doing. They thought they were discovering truth. How many times Talavera had wished to speak to them with utter scorn. Here is the only truth that matters, he wanted to say. Spain is at war, purifying Iberia as a Christian land. The king has conducted this war deftly and patiently, and he will win, driving the last Moors from Iberia. The queen is now setting into motion what England wisely did years ago, the expulsion of the Jews from her kingdom. Not that the Jews were dangerous by intent. Talavera had no sympathy with Torquemada's fanatical belief in the evil plots of the Jews. No, the Jews had to be expelled because as long as the weaker Christians could look around them and see unbelievers prospering, see them marrying and having children and living normal and decent lives, they would not be firm in their faith that only in Christ is their happiness. The Jews had to go, just as the Moors had to go. And what had Colón to do with this? Sailing west. So what? Even if he was right, what would it accomplish? Convert the heathen in a far-off land when Spain itself was not yet unified in its Christianity? That would be marvelous and well worth the effort, as long as it didn't interfere in any way with the war against the Moors. So, while the others argued about the size of the earth and the passability of the ocean sea, Talavera was always weighing far more important matters. What would the news of this expedition do to the prestige of the crown? What would it cost, and how would the diversion of such funds affect the war? Would supporting Colón cause Aragon and Castile to draw closer together or farther apart? What do the king and queen actually want to do? If Colón were sent away, where would he go next, and what would he do? Until today, the answers had all been clear enough. The king did not intend to spend one peso on anything but the war against the Moors, while the queen very much wanted to support Colón's expedition. That meant that any decision at all would be divisive. In the delicate balance between king and queen, between Aragon and Castile, any decision on Colón's expedition would cause one of them to think that power had drifted dangerously in the other direction, and suspicion and envy would increase. Therefore, regardless of all the arguments, Talavera was determined that no verdict would be reached until the situation changed. It was easy enough at first, but as the years passed and it became clear that Colón had nothing new to offer, it became harder and harder to keep the issue alive. Fortunately, Colón was the only other person involved in the process who seemed to understand it. Or if he didn't understand it, at least he cooperated with Talavera to this degree. He kept hinting that he knew more than he was telling. Veiled references to information he learned while in Lisbon or Madeira, mentions of proofs that had not yet been brought forward, this was what allowed Talavera to keep the examination open. When Maldonado, and Deza, for opposite reasons, wanted him to force Colón to lay these great secrets on the table, to settle things once and for all, Talavera always agreed that it would be a great help if Colón would do so. But one must understand that anything Colón learned in Portugal must have been learned under sacred oath. If it was just a matter of fear of Portuguese reprisals, then no doubt Colón would tell, for he was a brave man and not afraid of anything King John might do. But if it was a matter of honor, then how could they insist that he break his oath and tell? That would be the same as asking Colón to damn himself to hell for all eternity, just to satisfy their curiosity. Therefore, they must listen carefully to all that Colón said, hoping that, clever scholars that they were, they could determine just what it was he could not tell them openly. And by the grace of God, Colón himself played along. Surely the others had all taken him aside at one time or another, trying to pry from him the secrets that he would not tell. And in all these long years, Colón had never given a hint of what his secret information was. Just as important, he had also never given a hint that there was no secret information. For a long time, Talavera had not studied the arguments. He had grasped those at the start, and nothing important had been added in years. No, what Talavera studied was Colón himself. At first he had assumed that Colón was just another courtier on the make, but that impression was quickly dispelled. Colón was absolutely, fanatically determined to sail west, and could not be distracted by any other sort of preferment. Gradually, though, Talavera had come to see that this voyage west was not an end in itself. Colón had dreams, not of personal wealth or fame, but rather dreams of power. Colón wanted to accomplish something, and this westward voyage was the foundation of it. And what was it that Colón wanted to do? Talavera had puzzled about this for months, for years. Today, at last, the answer had come. Departing from his usual scholarly bludgeoning, Maldonado had remarked, rather testily, that it was selfish of Colón to try to distract the monarchs from their war with the Moors, and Colón had suddenly erupted in anger. A war with the Moors? For what, to drive them from Granada, from a small corner of this dry peninsula? With the wealth of the East, we could drive the Turk from Constantinople, and from there it is only a short step to Armageddon and the liberation of the Holy Land. And you tell me that I must not do this because it might interfere with the war against Granada? You might as well tell a matador that he cannot kill the bull because it might interfere with the effort to stomp on a mouse. At once Colón had regretted his remarks and was quick to reassure everyone that he had nothing but the greatest enthusiasm for the great war against Granada. "Forgive me for letting my passion rule my mouth," said Colón. "Never for a moment have I wished for anything but the victory of the Christian armies over the infidel in Granada." Talavera had immediately forgiven him and forbidden anyone to repeat Colón's remarks. "We know that what you said was in zeal for the cause of Christ, wishing that we could accomplish even more victory against Granada, not less." Colón himself seemed relieved indeed to hear Talavera's words. It could have been the death of his petition right on the spot if his remarks had been taken as disloyalty, and the personal consequences could have been severe as well. The others had also nodded wisely. They had no wish to denounce Colón. For one thing, it would hardly redound to their credit if it had taken them this many years to discover that Colón was a traitor. What Colón did not know, what none of them knew, was how deeply his words had touched Talavera's soul. A crusade to liberate Constantinople, to break the power of the Turk, to plunge a knife into the heart of Islam. In a few sentences, Colón had forced Talavera to view his life's work in a new light. All these years that Talavera had devoted himself to the cause of Spain for Christ's sake, and now he realized that next to Colón, his own faith was childish. Colón is right. If we serve Christ, why are we chasing mice when the great bull of Satan struts through the greatest Christian city? For the first time in years, Talavera realized that serving the king and queen might not be identical to serving the cause of Christ. He realized that for the first time in his life, he was in the presence of someone whose devotion to Christ might well be the match of his own. Such was my pride, thought Talavera, that it took me this many years to see it. And in those years, what have I done? I have kept Colon trapped here, leading him on, keeping the question open year after year, all because making any kind of decision might weaken the relationship between Aragon and Castile. Yet what if it is Colon and not Ferdinand and Isabella, who understands what will best serve the cause of Christ? How does the purification of Spain compare to the liberation of all the ancient Christian lands? And with the power of Islam broken, what then would stop Christianity from spreading forth to fill the world? If only Colon had come to us with a plan for crusade, instead of this strange voyage to the West. The man was eloquent, forceful, and there was something about him that made you want to be on his side. Talavera imagined him going from king to king, from court to court. He might well have been able to convince the monarchs of Europe to unite in common cause against the Turk. Instead, Colon seemed sure that the only way to bring about such a crusade was to establish a direct, quick connection with the great kingdoms of the East. Well, what if he was right? What if God had put this vision in his mind? Certainly it was nothing an intelligent man would have thought of on his own. The most rational plan was to sail around Africa, as the Portuguese were doing. But wasn't that, too, a species of madness? Weren't there ancient writers who had assumed that Africa extended all the way to the South Pole, so there was no way to sail around it? Yet the Portuguese had persisted, finding again and again that no matter how far south they sailed, Africa was always there, extending even farther than they had imagined. Yet last year, Dias had at last returned with the good news. They had rounded a cape and found that the coast ran to the east, not to the south. And then, after hundreds of miles, it definitely ran to the northeast and then the north. They had rounded Africa. And now the irrational persistence of the Portuguese was widely known to be rational after all. Couldn't Colon's irrational plans turn out the same way? Only instead of a years-long voyage, his route to the Orient would bring wealth much faster, and his plan, instead of enriching a tiny, useless country like Portugal, would lead eventually to the Church of Christ filling the entire world. So now, instead of thinking how to drag out the examination of Colon, waiting for the desires of the monarchs to resolve themselves, Talavera sat in his austere chamber trying to think how to force the issue. One thing he certainly could not do was suddenly, after all these years and with no significant new arguments, announce that the committee was deciding in favor of Colon. Maldonado and his supporters would protest directly to the king's men, and a power struggle would ensue. The queen would almost certainly lose such an open struggle, since her support from the lords of her realm depended in large part on the fact that she was known to think like a man. Disagreeing openly with the king would give the lie to that idea. Thus, open support for Colon would lead to division and probably would not lead to a voyage. No, Talavera thought, the one thing I cannot do is support Colon. So what can I do? I can set him free. I can end the process and let him go on to another king, to another court. Talavera well knew that Colon's friends had made discreet inquiries in the courts of France and England. Now that the Portuguese had achieved their quest for an African route to the east, they might be able to afford a small exploratory expedition toward the west. Certainly the Portuguese advantage in trading with the Orient will be envied by other kings. Colon might well succeed somewhere. So whatever else happens, I must end his examination immediately. But could there not also be a way to end the examination and yet turn things to the advantage of Colon's supporters? With a half-formed plan in mind, Talavera sent to the queen a note, bearing his request for a secret audience with her on the matter of Colon.
Tagiri did not understand her own reaction to the news of success from the scientists working on time travel. She should be happy. She should be rejoicing to know that her great work could, physically, be accomplished. Yet ever since meeting with the team of physicists, mathematicians, and engineers working on the time travel project, she had been upset, angry, frightened. The opposite of how she had expected she would feel. Yes, they said, we can send a living person into the past. But if we do so, there is no chance whatsoever, that our present world will survive in any form. To send someone into the past to change it is the end of ourselves. They were so patient, trying to explain temporal physics to historians. If our time is destroyed, Hassan asked, then won't that also destroy the very people that we send back? If none of us are ever born, then the people we send won't have been born either, and therefore they could never have been sent. No, explained the physicists, you're confusing causality with time. Time itself, as a phenomenon, is utterly linear and unidirectional. Each moment happens only once and passes into the next moment. Our memories grasp this one-way flow of time, and in our minds we link it with causality. We know that if A causes B, then A must come before B. But there is nothing in the physics of time that requires this. Think of what your predecessors did. The machine they sent back in time was the product of a long causal network. Those causes were all real, and the machine actually existed. Sending it back in time did not undo any of the events that led to the creation of that machine. But in the moment that the machine caused Columbus to see his vision on that beach in Portugal, it began to transform the causal network so that it no longer led to the same place. All of those causes and effects really happened. The ones leading to the creation of the machine, and the ones following from the machine's introduction into the 15th century. But then you're saying that their future still exists, Hunapu protested. That depends on how you define existence, they explained. As a part of the causal network leading to the present moment, yes, they continue to exist in the sense that any part of their causal network that led to the existence of their machine in our time is still having effects in the present world. But anything peripheral or irrelevant to that is now utterly without effect in our time stream. And anything in their history that the introduction of that machine in our history caused not to happen is utterly and irrevocably lost. We can't go back into our past and view it because it didn't happen. But it did happen because their machine exists. No, they said again. Causality can be recursive, but time cannot. Anything that the introduction of their machine caused not to happen did not, in fact, happen in time. There is no moment of time in which those events exist. Therefore, they cannot be seen or visited, because the temporal loci which they occupied are now occupied by different moments. Two contradictory sets of events cannot occupy the same moment. You are only confused because you cannot separate causality from time. And that's perfectly natural, because time is rational. Causality is irrational. We've been playing speculative games with the mathematics of time for centuries, but we would never have seen this distinction between time and causality ourselves if we hadn't had to account for the machine from the future. So what you're saying, Deco offered, is that the other history still exists, but we just can't see it with our machines. That's not what we're saying, they replied with infinite patience. Anything that was not causally connected to the creation of that machine cannot be said to have ever existed at all. And anything that did lead to the creation of that machine and its introduction into our time exists only in the sense that unreal numbers exist. But they did exist, Tagiri said, more passionately than she had expected. They did! They did not! Said old Manjam, who had let his younger colleagues speak for him till now. We mathematicians are quite comfortable with this. We have never dwelt in the realm of reality. But of course your mind rebels against it because your mind exists in time. What you must understand is that causality is not real. It does not exist in time. Moment A does not really cause moment B in reality. Moment A exists, and then moment B exists. And between them are moments A point A through A point Z. And between A point A and A point B, there are A point AA through A point AZ. None of these moments actually touches any other moment. That is what reality is. An infinite array of discrete moments unconnected with any other moment, because each moment in time has no linear dimension. When the machine was introduced into our history, from that point forward, a new infinite set of moments completely replaced the old infinite set of moments. There were no spare leftover moment locations for the old moments to hang around in. And because there was no time for them, they didn't happen. But causality is unaffected by this. It isn't geometric. It has a completely different mathematics, one which does not fit well with concepts like space and time, and certainly doesn't fit within anything that you could call real. There is no space or time in which those events happened. What does that mean? Said Hassan. That if we send somebody back in time, they will suddenly cease to remember anything about the time they came from, because that time no longer exists? The person that you sent back, said Manjam, is a discrete event. He will have a brain. And that brain will contain memories that, when he accesses them, will give him certain information. This information will cause him to think he remembers a whole reality, a world and a history. But all that exists in reality is him and his brain. The causal network will only include those causal connections which led to the creation of his physical body, including his brain state. But any part of that causal network which is not part of the new reality cannot be said to exist in any way. Tagiri was shaken. I don't care that I don't understand the science of it, she said. I only know that I hate it. It's always frightening to deal with something that is counterintuitive, said Manjam. Not at all, said Tagiri, trembling. I didn't say I was frightened. I'm not. I'm angry and frustrated, horrified.
Horrified about the mathematics of time.
Horrified at what we are doing, at what the interveners actually did. I suppose that I always felt that in some sense they went on, that they sent their machine and then went on with their lives, comforted in their miserable situation by knowing that they had done something to help their ancestors. But that was never possible, said Manjam. I know it, said Tagiri. And so when I really thought about it, I imagined them sending the machine, and in that moment they sort of disappeared, a clean, painless death for everyone. But at least they had lived up to that moment.
Well, said Manjam,
how is clean, painless non-existence any worse than a clean, painless death? You see, said Tagiri, it's not. Not any worse. And not any better, either, for the people themselves.
What people? Said Manjam, shrugging.
Us, Manjam. We are talking about doing this to ourselves.
If you do this, then there will have been no such people as ourselves.
The only aspect of our causal network that will have any future or past are those that are connected to the creation of the physical bodies and mental states of the persons you send into the past. This is all so silly, said Deco. Who cares about what's real and what isn't real? Isn't this what we wanted all along? To make it so that the terrible events of our history never happened in the first place? And as for our own history, the parts that will be lost, who cares if a mathematician calls us dirty names like unreal? They say such slanders about the square root of negative two as well. Everyone laughed, but not Tagiri. They did not see the past as she saw it, or rather, they didn't feel the past. They didn't understand that to her, looking through the tempo view and the true sight too, the past was alive and real. Just because the people were dead did not mean that they were not still part of the present, because she could go back and recover them, see them, hear them, know them, at least as well as any human being ever knows any other. Even before the true sight and the tempo view, though, the dead still lived in memory, some kind of memory. But not if they changed the past. It was one thing to ask humankind of today to choose to give up their future in the hope of creating a new reality. That would be hard enough. But to also reach back and kill the dead, to uncreate them as well. And they had no vote. They could not be asked. We must not do this, she thought. This is wrong. This will be a worse crime than the ones we are trying to prevent. She got up and left the meeting. Deco and Hassan tried to leave with her, but she brushed them off. I need to be alone, she said. And so they stayed behind, returning to a meeting that she knew would be in shambles. For a moment she felt remorse at having greeted the physicist's triumphant moment with such a negative response. But as she walked the streets of Juba, that remorse faded, replaced by one far deeper. The children playing naked in the dirt and weeds, the men and women going about their business. She spoke to them all in her heart, saying, "How would you like to die? And not only you, but your children and their children. And not only them, but your parents, too. Let's go back into the graves, open them up, and kill them all. Every good and evil thing they did, all their joy, all their suffering, all their choices. Let's kill them all, erase them, undo them. Reaching back and back and back until we finally come to the golden moment that we have chosen, declaring it worthy to continue to exist, but with a new future tied to the end of it. And why must all of you and yours be killed? Because in our judgment, they didn't make a good enough world. Their mistakes along the way were so unforgivable that they erased the value of any good that also happened. All must be obliterated. How dare I? How dare we? Even if we got the unanimous consent of all the people of our own time, how will we poll the dead? She picked her way down the bluffs to the riverside. In the waning afternoon, the heat of the day was finally beginning to break. In the distance, hippos were bathing or feeding or sleeping. Birds were calling, getting ready for their frenzied feeding on the insects of the dusk. What goes through your minds, birds, hippopotamuses, insects of the late afternoon? Do you like being alive? Do you fear death? You kill to live. You die so others can live. It's the path ordained for you by evolution, by life itself. But if you had the power, wouldn't you save yourselves? She was still there by the river when the darkness came, when the stars came out. For a moment, gazing at the ancient light of the stars, she thought, why should I worry about uncreating so much of human history? Why should I care that it will be worse than forgotten, that it will be unknown? Why should that seem to be a crime, when all of human history is an eye blink compared to the billions of years the stars have shone? We will all be forgotten in the last exhalation of our history. What does it matter, then, if some are forgotten sooner than others, or if some are caused to have never existed at all? Oh, this is such a wise perspective, to compare human lives to the lives of stars. The only problem is that it cuts both ways. If in the long run it doesn't matter that we wipe out billions of lives in order to save our ancestors, then in the long run saving our ancestors doesn't matter either, so why bother changing the past at all? The only perspective that matters is the human one, Tagiri knew. We are the only ones who care. We are the actors and the audience as well, all of us. And the critics. We are also the critics. The light of an electric torch bobbed into view as she heard someone approaching through the grass. That torch will only attract animals that we don't want, she said. Come home, said Diko. It isn't safe out here, and Father's worried. Why should he be worried? My life doesn't exist. I never lived. You're alive now, and so am I, and so are the crocodiles. If individual lives don't matter, said Tagiri, then why bother going back to make them better? And if they do matter, then how dare we snuff some out in favor of others? And if they do matter, then how dare we snuff some out in favor of others? Individual lives matter, said Diko. But life also matters. Life as a whole. That's what you've forgotten today. That's what Manjam and the other scientists also forgot. They talk of all these moments, separate, never touching, and say that they are the only reality. Just as the only reality of human life is individuals, isolated individuals who never really know each other, never really touch at any point. No matter how close you are, you're always separate. Tagiri shook her head. This has nothing to do with what is bothering me. It has everything to do with it, said Diko. Because you know that this is a lie. You know that the mathematicians are wrong about the moments, too. They do touch. Even if we can't really touch causality, the connections between moments, that doesn't mean they aren't real. And just because whenever you look closely at the human race, at a community, at a family, all you can ever find are separate individuals, that doesn't mean that the family is not also real. After all, when you look closely enough at a molecule, all you can see are atoms. There's no physical connection between them. And yet the molecule is still real because of the way the atoms affect each other. You're as bad as they are, said Tagiri, answering anguish with analogies. Analogies are all I have, said Diko. Truth is all I have, and truth is never a comfort. But understanding truth, that is what you taught me to do. So here is the truth. What human life is, what it's for, what we do, is create communities. Some of them are good, some of them are evil, or somewhere between. You taught me this, didn't you? and there are communities of communities, groups of groups, and what makes them good or bad? Demanded Tagiri. The quality of the individual lives. The ones we're going to snuff out. No, said Diko. What we're going to do is go back and revise the ultimate community of communities. The human race as a whole. History as a whole here on this planet. We're going to create a new version of it. One that will give the new individuals who live within it a far, far better chance of happiness, of having a good life, than the old version. That's real, and that's good, Mother. It's worth doing. It is. I've never known any groups, said Tagiri. Just people. Just individual people. Why should I make those people pay so this imaginary thing called human history can be better? Better for whom? But, Mother, individual people always sacrifice for the sake of the community. When it matters enough, people sometimes even die, willingly, for the good of the community that they feel themselves to be a part of. And 1,000 sacrifices short of death. And why? Why do we give up our individual desires, leave them unfulfilled, or work hard at tasks we hate or fear because others need us to do them? Why these sacrifices? Why did you go through such pain to bear me and Acho? Why did you give up all the time it took to take care of us? Tagiri looked at her daughter. I don't know, but as I listen to you, I begin to think that perhaps it was worth it. Because you know things that I don't know. I wanted to create someone different from myself, better than myself, and willingly gave up part of my life to do it. And here you are. And you're saying that that's what the people of our time will be to the people of the new history we create. That we will sacrifice to create their history, as parents sacrifice to create healthy, happy children. Yes, Mother, said Diko. Manjam is wrong. The people who sent that vision to Columbus did exist. They were the parents of our age. We are their children, and now we will be the parents to another age. Which just goes to show, said Tagiri, that one can always find language to make the most terrible things sound noble and beautiful, so you can live with doing them. Diko looked at Tagiri in silence for a long moment. Then she threw the electric torch to the ground at her mother's feet and walked away into the night. Isabella found herself dreading the meeting with Talavera. It would be about Cristóbal Colón, of course. It must mean that he had reached a conclusion. It's foolish of me, don't you think? Isabella said to Lady Felicia. Yet I am as worried about his verdict as if I myself were on trial. Lady Felicia murmured something non-committal. Perhaps I am on trial. What court on earth can try a queen, Your Majesty? Asked Lady Felicia. That is my point, said Isabella. I felt, when Cristóbal spoke that first day in court, so many years ago, that the Holy Mother was offering me something very sweet and fine. A fruit from her own garden, a berry from her own vine. He is a fascinating man, Your Majesty. Not him, though I do think him a sweet and fervent fellow. One thing Isabella would never do was leave the impression with anyone that she looked on any man but her husband with anything approaching desire. No, I mean that the Queen of Heaven was giving me the chance to open a vast door that had long been closed. She sighed. But the power even of queens is not infinite. I had no ships to spare, and the cost of saying yes on the spot would have been too great. Now Talavera has decided, and I fear that he is about to close a door whose key will only be given me that one time. Now it will pass into another hand, and I will regret it forever. Heaven cannot condemn your majesty for failing to do what was not within your power to do, said Lady Felicia. I'm not worried at this moment about the condemnation of heaven. That's between me and my confessors. Oh, your majesty, I was not saying that you face any kind of condemnation from... No, no, Lady Felicia, don't worry. I didn't take your remark as anything but the kindest reassurance. Felicia, still flustered, got up to answer the soft knock on the door. It was Father Talavera. Would you wait by the door, Lady Felicia? Asked Isabella. Talavera bowed over her hand. Your Majesty, I am about to ask Father Maldonado to write the verdict. The worst possible outcome. She heard the door of heaven clang shut against her. Why today of all days? She asked him. You've taken all these years over this Colón fellow, and today it's suddenly an emergency that must be decided at once. I think it is, he said. And why is that? Because victory in Granada is near. Oh? Has God spoken to you about this? You feel it too. Not God, of course, but His Majesty the King. There is new energy in him. He is making the final push, and he knows that it will succeed. This next summer, by the end of 1491, all of Spain will be free of the Moor. And this means that you must press the issue of Colón's voyage now? It means, said Talavera, that one who wishes to do something so audacious must sometimes proceed very warily. Imagine, if you will, what would happen if our verdict were positive. Go ahead, Your Majesty, we say. This voyage is worthy of success. What then? At once, Maldonado and his friends will seek His Majesty's ear, criticizing this voyage. And they will speak to many others, so that the voyage will soon be known as a folly. In particular, Isabella's folly. She raised an eyebrow. I say only what will surely be said by those with malicious hearts. Now imagine if this verdict is reached when the war is over, and His Majesty can devote his full attention to the matter. The issue of this voyage could easily become quite a stumbling block in the relations between the two kingdoms. I see that, in your view, supporting Colón will be disastrous, she said. Now imagine, Your Majesty, that the verdict is negative. In fact, that Maldonado himself writes it. From that point on, Maldonado has nothing to gossip about. There will be no whispers. There will also be no voyage. Won't there? Asked Talavera. I imagine a day when a queen might say to her husband, Father Talavera came to me, and we agreed that Father Maldonado should write the verdict. But I don't agree. I imagine this queen saying to her husband, We agreed that Maldonado should write the verdict because we know that the war with Granada is the most vital concern of our kingdom. We want nothing to distract you or anyone else from this holy crusade against the Moor. Most certainly we don't want to give King John of Portugal reason to think we are planning any kind of voyage through waters he thinks of as his own. We need his unflagging friendship during this final struggle with Granada. So even though, in my heart, I want nothing more than to take the chance and send this Colón west to carry the cross to the great kingdoms of the east, I have set aside this dream. "What an eloquent queen you have imagined," said Isabella. "All controversy dies. The king sees the queen as a statesman of great wisdom. He also sees the sacrifice she has made for their kingdoms and the cause of Christ. Now, imagine that time passes. The war is won. In the glow of victory, the queen comes to the king and says, 'Now, let's see if this Colón still wants to sail west.' And he will say, 'I thought that business was finished. I thought Talavera's examiners put a stop to all that nonsense.'" "Oh, does he say that?" asked Talavera. "Fortunately, the queen is quite deft, and she says, 'Oh, but you know that Talavera and I agreed to have Maldonado write that verdict. For the good of the war effort, the matter was never really settled. Many of the examiners thought Colón's project was a worthy one, with a decent chance of success. Who can know, anyway? We'll find out by sending this Colón. If he comes back successful, we'll know he was right, and we'll send great expeditions at once to follow through. If he comes back empty-handed, then we'll put him in prison for defrauding the crown. And if he never comes back, we'll waste no more effort on such projects. The queen, you imagine, is so dry," said Isabella. "She talks like a cleric." "It's a shortcoming of mine," said Talavera. "I haven't heard enough great ladies in private conversation with their husbands." "I think this queen should say to her husband, 'If he sails and never returns, then we have lost a handful of caravels. Pirates take more than that every year. But if he sails and succeeds, then with 3 caravels, we will have accomplished more than Portugal has achieved in a century of expensive, dangerous voyages along the African coast.'" "Oh, you're right. That's much better. This king that you're imagining, he has a keen sense of competition." "Portugal is a thorn in his side," said Isabella. "So you agree with me that Maldonado should write the verdict?" "You're forgetting one thing," said Isabella.
"And that is?"
"Colón. When the verdict comes, he will leave us and head for France or England, or Portugal. There are 2 reasons why he will not, Your Majesty."
"And those are?"
"First, Portugal has Dias and the African route to the Indies. While I happen to know that Colón's first approaches to Paris and London, through intermediaries, did not meet with any encouragement."
"He has already turned to other kings."
"After the first 4 years," said Talavera dryly, "his patience began to flag a little."
"And the second reason that Colón will not leave Spain between the verdict and the end of the war with Granada?"
"He will be informed of the verdict of the examiners in a letter. And that letter, while it will contain no promises, will nevertheless give him leave to understand that when the war ends, the matter can be reopened.
The verdict closes the door, but the letter opens the window?
Just a little. But if I know Colón at all, that slight crack in the window will be enough. He is a man of great hopes and great tenacity.
Do I take it, Father Talavera, that your own personal verdict is in favor of the voyage?
Not at all, said Talavera. If I had to guess which view of the world is the more correct, I think I would favor Ptolemy and Maldonado. But I would be guessing, because no one knows, and no one can know with the information we now have.
Then why did you come here today with all these suggestions?
I think of them as imaginings, Your Majesty. I would not presume to suggest anything.
He smiled.
While the others have been trying to determine what is correct, I have been thinking more along the lines of what is good and right. I have been thinking of St. Peter stepping from the boat and walking on the water, until he doubted, and then he was lifted up by the hand of the Savior.
Tears came to Isabella's eyes. Do you think Colón may be filled with the Spirit of God?
The Maid of Orléans was either a saint or a madwoman.
Or a witch.
They burned her as a witch. My point exactly. Who could know, for certain, whether God was in her? And yet, by putting their trust in her as God's servant, the soldiers of France drove the English from field after field. What if she had been mad? What then? They would have lost one more battle. What difference would that have made? They had already lost so many.
So if Colón is a madman, we will only lose a few caravels, a little money, a wasted voyage.
Besides, if I know His Majesty at all, I suspect he'll find a way to get the boats for very little money.
They say that if you pinch the coins with his face on them, they screech.
Talavera's eyes went wide. Someone told Your Majesty that little jest? She lowered her voice. They were already talking so low that Lady Felicia could not possibly hear them. Still, he leaned toward the Queen so he could hear her faint whisper.
Father Talavera, just between you and me, when that little jest was first told, I was present. In fact, when that little jest was first told, I was speaking.
I will treat that, said Father Talavera, with all the secrecy of a confession.
You are such a good priest, Father Talavera. Bring me Father Maldonado's verdict. Tell him not to make it too cruel.
Your Majesty, I will tell him to be kind. But Father Maldonado's kindness can leave scars.
Deco came home to find father and mother both still awake, dressed, sitting up in the front room, as if they were waiting to go somewhere, which turned out to be the case. Manjum has asked to see us. At this hour, asked Deco. Go then. Us, said Father, including you. They met in one of the smaller rooms at Pastwatch, but one designed for the optimum viewing of the holographic display of the true sight too. It did not occur to Deco, however, that Manjum chose the room for anything but privacy. What would he need with the true sight too? He was not of Pastwatch. He was a noted mathematician, but that was supposed to mean that he had no use for the real world. His tool was a computer for number manipulation, and of course his own mind. After Hassan, Tagiri, and Deco arrived, Manjum had them wait just a moment more for Hunapu and Kamal. Then they all sat. "I must begin with an apology."